before I bring Rana up here. AA is my home now, and it is everywhere. I go to meetings when I travel here or in foreign countries, and the people are family. I can know because of what we share. As I write this, in my 28th year of sobriety, I am amazed to look back and remember the woman or child I was then, to see how far I've come out of that abyss. Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to move from fantasies about what I might do with my life into living it one day at a time. I now announce Rana Yellowcoat.
Hi, everyone. Let me get this timer going on here. So, all right.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rana. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I just want to say thank you so much for those of you who stayed. I know it's getting late. I know, and I'm going to tell on Dick because where is he anyway? Did he leave? Oh, because he was like telling me, he says, are you funny? Because, you know, we're going to be tired by the time you go up there and talk. And so, you know, we need you to be funny. And I was like, Michelle. So, yeah, I was like, oh, great, what the pressure. So, but I hope that you got your donuts and your cookies to keep you, that, you know, that sugar rush going for a little bit longer. And I do thank you for staying. I'm grateful to be fully present and connected to each and every one of you tonight in the way that we are. It's a time in my life that wasn't the case, but I want to say thank you for that. I want to say thank you to Michael for inviting me to come and be a part of Pockets of Enthusiasm. I want to say thank you to Laura for taking care of me over the weekend and over the week, you know, of getting to meet her and checking in and making sure I was all right. And, you know, being able to have someone to contact when we hit that traffic advantage. I mean, goodness. It was. And so being, you know, want to say thank you to the committee for, you know, because I think you have to vote and agree. I don't know. I was doing this talk. I was invited to go to Indonesia. And they said, can you send us a tape? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, what, are you going to listen to the tape? And then if it's not good, you're going to be like, sorry. I was like, how well do you think I am? You know, I was like, my goodness. But, you know, I just want to say thank you. I don't know if you had to listen to a tape, but I'm grateful that I get to be here and share my experience, strength, and hope. I have a friend. His name is Don C. He's a Mohican elder. And, you know, Don had taught me that, you know, he comes up and he introduced, I'm an alcoholic first. Because as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, today I'm able to represent my tribe. You know, and before that, you know, I was just a, you know, it talks about, you know, I was an unadjusted woman, undisciplined, maladjusted to life, you know, and filled with nameless fears when I got to you. And the fact that, you know, I've been following under the guidance of your AA's disciplines is that I'm the woman that stands before you today. My sobriety date is April 27th, 1997. And, yeah, I got in the 1900s. And, yeah, my home group is the Federal Way Women's Book Study, and just I love them. And, yeah, thank you. I brought my little cheerleader with me. I'm really thankful that thank you for taking care of both of us and really appreciate that. So, yeah, I'm from the Cree Nation. I'm of the Chippewa Cree Tribe of Rocky Boy, Montana. And I come from a family of storytellers, like my father was. And, you know, over the years, you know, with my Native American flutes, I have accumulated the story through books that I've read, through people coming up and telling me things about the caterpillar and butterfly, the things that I knew about caterpillar and butterfly. And, well, the story goes is that when you see a caterpillar, you're not going to call it a butterfly. And when you see a butterfly, you're not going to call it a caterpillar. And yet the butterfly is the higher expression. And one day there's this little caterpillar, and he's scooching along, and he's minding his own business, not minding being a caterpillar at all. And he looks up, and he sees this butterfly flitting in the air, and the caterpillar says, "You will never catch me and one of those contraptions." I know I tell that story to when I'm on the road to people that aren't alcoholics, so I always know when I get those laughters out there who they are. So, yeah, the thing of it is that, did you know that when it's time for the caterpillar to create the chrysalis, it gets a vibration throughout its body, and it knows from the intelligence within that it's time to create the chrysalis. And it's only within the stillness and the quietness and the darkness of that cocoon where the magic is able to take place. And there's this saying that I learned in AA that just when the caterpillar believed it was going to die, it became the butterfly. And to me, it's just that place that, you know, when you just feel you can't go on one more, but you surrender and you do, you know. But the cool thing about this is when you're looking at it, when it's time for the butterfly to come out of the cocoon, did you know that it needs every single movement in pushing that cocoon off its body, because it strengthens its body. And it sends energy to the wings so that it could fly. And if I were to happen upon that transformation, it's happened upon that struggle. Oh, you poor little butterfly, you can't do that without my help. You know, but Michelle, she was a good example of that today. That's why we have that other program. You know, and I were to take and I were to pull the cocoon's body off of the butterfly, that the butterfly would fall to the ground and it would die. And it would lose the experience of butterfly. This is our story. The thing about this is not a really beautiful, I mean, it's a beautiful story when you think about it in those terms, but it's actually pretty grotesque. If you Wikipedia what it looks like within the cocoon when it's not a when it's not a caterpillar and it's not a butterfly, it's just a bunch of muck, you know? And so I know that I've never been through a transformation where I wasn't this anymore, but I was not yet that. And I was in that place of the desert where what am I? You know, and having to stay within the patience of Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to find that I am. And the beautiful thing that I love about this transformation is that you can't be the butterfly without being the caterpillar. And what that means to me is that my lower states of being were necessary so that I can guide the women and some men to understand it from a spiritual, from a physical, and a mental way, to be able to guide them, to be the woman that I am today. And for that, I say thank you. As I come from a family of Indigenous people, my grandmother, family comes from Canada, from Saskatchewan, a little place right outside of Regina called Paiute. And it's part of the Paiute clan. And my grandmother actually had to come into the States because she had gone blind. And she actually sent her to Seattle to learn how to do Braille. And following her, you know, when she was done with that, she ended up staying in Montana. And then following her were my mom, my aunties, and uncles. And as a young girl, I didn't really understand what I was seeing. I saw a lot of violence. I saw a lot of drunkenness. I would not have been able to give it that term. But I saw, you know, my aunties and my mom, they would go at it, or two aunties going at it, or my mom and dad, and alcoholism was very alive within our home. My very first drink, I was 4 years old. I was, I remember it. And the reason why I remember is because of the effect produced. I liked what I was feeling. My auntie was babysitting me. She was a teenager. She wanted me to probably maybe pass out so she can party with her friends. And I remember I was drinking this drink, and I was staggering all over, and people were laughing, and I liked that. You know, and I remember back in our day, we used to have those TVs that when you turned them off, there was a little white light in it, right? And it would just get smaller and smaller and smaller, and it would just go out. And that's exactly what happened to that little girl, just passed out. But I always remember that feeling. And I didn't drink for a long time after that, to my teenage years. And, teenage years, I could kind of try things. Well, unless my parents had a party and I would go after and I would kind of look in. They'd have these cans of beer, you know, after a party. And I would kind of taste them, swing them back, you know. And every once in a while, you get that butt in there, you know. That was disgusting, you know. Ooh, but I wouldn't stop. You know, I'm still going around looking. So, okay, so that just came into effect. But, it wasn't, you know, for me, what happened was that when my aunties, all of a sudden they were there and then they were gone. And I didn't know till later on that they had died from cirrhosis of the liver. My mom almost died from cirrhosis of the liver. She was in eventually we were taken away from my mom. We were constantly in and out of foster care because, you know, as many of us can attest to, is that alcohol and children don't mix. And so we were in and out of foster care homes, and my dad ended up divorcing my mom, and we stayed with my dad. And my mom kept on drinking like that, and she ended up in Galen, Montana, and a place where she was going to die from her alcoholism. And she tells me the story that, you know, she was in the state of DTs where she could see alcohol right beside her. She was in a place where, you know, her mind was, you know, playing tricks on her. But she had a moment of clarity where she said a prayer. And in that prayer, she said, she asked Creator if she could come back and make it right with her kids. And I'm here to tell you, though my mom left, she died in 2005, that she left her children a legacy of 25 years of sobriety. And, And I got to spend 8 years of that in my sobriety with her. But that didn't come, you know, how I got to you is like, you know, as I, you know, I don't want to go really long into my drunkalogue, but I'll just tell you some of the things is that when I got to you, my children were living in Montana with their dad, being raised by their dad, you know, and I felt a lot of shame around that. And the way that I would handle that is I wouldn't let you get too close lest I had to tell you and had to look at that and feel that shame. And so I just kept distance from you, only let you know what I wanted you to know. And I was in a space where, you know, I had gotten married. It was beautiful. You know, I remember thinking when I was 16, you know, one day I'm going to get married, you know, and I'm probably going to have kids. I wonder what they're going to look like. You know, I wonder what he's going to look like, you know, but I never once thought about that alcohol would be playing a part within that. And so, yeah, when I got to you, my children were being raised outside of me. And I wake up in those times when I would wonder in my clarity out of a drunk, what am I doing here and they're there? How did I get here? And but it took me that was one of my first bottoms, so it took me 9 years before I got to you. So you can imagine that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that I experienced getting to you. My last drink, I'm going to get to there. Okay, well, let me just tell you this one thing, because I got to really do qualify. So I got married, right, and I was so humiliated in the court by losing my children, right? Humiliation is all about me. And I never wanted to ever deal with that again. And so then when I left that relationship, I found another relationship, and I didn't get a divorce. But when I was asked to get married, I said yes. So I got married because I was afraid, you know. And so I just got married, and I was going to, you know, consequences were inconsequential. I was just going to go and I was going to do, you know, I was just going to do what I wanted to do, you know. But I did feel a sense of shame about it, you know. I'd be in the bar and I'd be drinking, though, you know, have that extemporaneous effect, you know, feeling outside of myself. People telling people, you know, I'm drunk and, you know, hey, that's bigamy, Rana. And I'd be like, no, that's bigamy, okay, you know. And I, you know, but there was a lot of shame. And when I got sober, that's not how I was acting. I was trying to hide it. I felt fear, you know, because I heard you might be able to go to prison for that. And so, but my last day of drinking, I was... I actually had gotten into outside issues, as Aaron was talking about. You know, I never wanted to get crack cocaine. I even remember saying, I don't want to try it because if I try it, I know I'll like it, you know. And sure enough, one drunk night, you know, I didn't have no defense against it. My friend said, hey, let's go cop. I was like, well, what does that mean? And so we went and got some, and I would probably say it got me here pretty quick. My bottoms got pretty quick. I was, I wanted what I wanted on April 26th, and I didn't have any money. And so I called the dealer, and I said, you know, do you take checks? And they typically don't, but this day she did, because I guess I've been dealing with her for a while, and I guess she just had trust in me. Why, I don't know. But anyway, I wrote her a check, and she gave me what I wanted. Me and my friend, we went and did what we did, and I was sitting there with my head in my knees, and I was done. I was drinking. Alcohol was the first. Alcohol was the last, right? But I was sitting there trying to drink myself in oblivion. I didn't understand that I was that the high that I was under wasn't letting me get the drunk that I like to get to. I didn't understand what was happening to me. I thought that it finally has not worked for me anymore. And so I ended up telling my friend, I don't want to do this anymore. And she said, yeah, you know, we'll go to treatment. And I heard about treatment before. From the dealer, I remember saying, you know, I was like, how do you not use that chunk of stuff? How do you not use it? She's like, well, because I went to treatment, right? So, and I was like, well, you know, it's the message, not the messenger, right? And so I had heard it then, and then the next morning when I woke up in that terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, at one more time, I was in this place again. And I looked at my husband and I said, I'm in trouble. You see, because I have been a pretty good liar, cheat, and thief. And I, you know, with a little help from his own denial, you know, I was able to get away with a lot of things. And when money went missing, you know, I had all these elaborate stories how that would happen. And, you know, yeah. And I was afraid because, and I think the thing for me was I was afraid because when you mess with people, that kind of people's money, I was afraid because they would come to my home and cause harm to me and my third child that I had at that time. So I'm walking around this fear, and I looked at my husband, I'm in trouble, and he says, why don't you go to treatment, Rana? And I was like, oh, why didn't you go to treatment? This is a bigger thing than this. You know, this is not, what's treatment? I don't even know what treatment is, you know. But I thought, okay, but I was in that space. I'm tired, you know. And so it was Sunday, and I didn't think treatment was open. So I kind of white-knuckled it through that day. And on that Monday, you know, I took the phone and, you know, the ones that hung on the wall. And I took that long cord and hid in the hallway in the dark, and I was on the phone with a man at the other end. And I, because, see, I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, see, alcoholics to me look like I didn't have a liver the size of a football, like my mom. You know, in our little town of Havre, Montana, we had a Lee's Tavern, and right next to there's logs, and that's where our town drunks would sit. Well, I wasn't doing that. I was still drinking out of cups. You know, and so I really had this denial going on for me. So I thought, well, I'll go to treatment. And I just thought I was going to get fixed because it was group health. And I thought it was like a hospital thing. And so you know how we are. We make that stuff up. And so I went. So I was on the phone with this guy on Monday morning. Though Sunday is my very first sobriety day. And I was talking to this guy. And I said, you know, I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, I'd like to come and get some help. And he's like, well, can you call back in like 2 weeks? You know? And, you know, without even knowing that part in the big book where it says we forget about the pain and suffering we endured a week or a month ago, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about that. But all I said was, I think I'm going to forget. And I don't think I'll call you back. And he must have read that book. And he said, hold on a second. Right, and he comes back, and they got me into treatment, and then treatment sent me to you. You know, but I think for me, I was just grateful to have a solution, You know, I was I think that I was just willing. And I've learned that. You don't have to like it to be willing. You don't have to be like, oh, I'm willing. You know, it can be like, oh, I don't want to go, but I'm going to go, you know. And, you know, I had a little bit of resistance to it, but I just was at the end of my rope. I knew that I was in a space where I was, you know, I was at a critical nature of my alcoholism. You know, that I had broken the rhythm of my heart by drinking, you know, a weekend of just hanging out with the Sacramento Air Force people. And we were just partying it up, you know, and drinking whiskey all weekend long. And that Sunday, I broke my heart. I have what's called chronic arrhythmia. And so, you know, every once in a while when I get nervous, I can start feeling that, you know, it'll start showing me that it's still there. But for the biggest part, you know, with the work that we've done together, that I feel a calm and a sense of goodness going on. But I, so different things like that. So I am an alcoholic. And I think that the interesting thing about it is that when I was reading those steps and I come into your meetings and I was reading those steps, I would think to myself, like, I'm powerless over alcohol. Well, that's obvious. You know, I mean, all the things that happened to me, waking up in jail, where's my car, who are you, you know, those kind of things happening all the time. Like, that made a sense, but, and my life was unmanageable with that little dash in between, is that I was sitting there mopping the floor, and I'm hanging out with you now. I'm mopping the floor, and I'm kind of doing it with a toothbrush, because perfectionism is part of my illness. And I was, my sister was looking at me, what are you doing? I was like, I can't help it, I'm perfect. You know? And she's like, Rhonda, she says, you're not perfect. You have perfectionism. You know, I didn't know the difference, you know, but I was sitting there and, you know, and I was sitting there thinking, well, what's the point of being sober? Like, if this stuff is going on in my head, what's the point of all that? You know, I had a racing mind. I had magnifying mind. And I had, before I had a solution that would soothe that. That would make things calm. And so here I'm just living with it, you know, wondering how in the heck are you doing it? And, you know, I went to a meeting and I shared about it. And it was like they got me in doing some work. And but I had this thing, you know, when I first went into AA, they got me to be a coffee maker. And, you know, I was always somebody like, you know, that was the thing that kept me coming back. It kept me coming back. And, you know, they told me that's when we have those great big bins and we use cups. And I remember they said, okay, now, Ronnie, what you do is you take and you put 12 of these inside here, and then you fill the water up right to here, right? And then like that. And I was like, 12? Well, let's try 14. You know? And I'm sitting there, and everybody's like, dang, Ronnie, this is some really good coffee. And I didn't know that you could get a buzz off coffee. I didn't start drinking it until I hung out with you, and that was my last resort, you know? But yeah, and then we got those really good creamers, you know, and all that good stuff. So yeah, I ended up, you know, they put me to work and I was coffee maker and it was still, I'm still walking the wire though, because I'm still amazed every day that I wake up from a drunk dream and it's not true, you know. And I remember one time my sister was getting ready to leave and I was feeling sorry for myself and you know, actually not my sister, my children were getting ready to go back to Montana from a visit, which, you know, I was able to get. I remember I was like, before when they would leave, I would let them go, but then I would go get bottles to drink. And what I did differently is I went to a meeting and I said, my children are getting ready to leave. And I'm afraid I might drink. And, cause that's what I always did. And, this beautiful woman named Rita came up to me and she gave me her phone number, you know, and, her name. But on the other side of that, she wrote, the biggest failure we make in life is giving up what we want the most for what we want right now. Change the thought before it becomes an action. And when I saw that, one of the things that I wanted the most was I just wanted to like the woman in the mirror. Because how many times would I wake up from the things that I had done from the night before? You know, that how many times would I wake up and then look in the mirror and then curse the woman in the mirror? I hated who I had become. And all I was just, I would have just liked to like her. You know, I just liked to like her. And the other part that I wanted the most was I wanted to be a good mom. And, you know, it just kind of looked like, you know, I wasn't going to be able to raise my children. But, you know, one day I was sitting there and I didn't know it was humility at the time. But I was standing in my living room and I was praying to Creator, please, help me to be the best mom I can be so Daniel and Donna can become the man and the woman that they are. And I only had them for 1 week and a month at that time. And I wasn't, it was different because usually I'm just like, you know, please God, can I please have them for longer than this? Or can, you know, and I was always asking for what I wanted. And I didn't know if you would have asked me at the time if you, what the difference between humility and humiliation, I would identified humility with humiliation just because they sound really a lot alike, you know. And, you know, and so as I was going through this and working, my, you know, it was the thing. I was sitting there one day with a glass of wine, and I don't know if every one of us has this moment where we have that choice. And I'm sitting there with this glass of wine in front of me, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I know this is going to just, it's going to give me that relief that I want. And then Rita's words came in my head. The biggest failure we make in life is giving up what we want the most for what we want right now. Change the thought before it becomes an action. And what do? How do I change the thought? Is I call my sponsor. I get to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you know, and I just began that process like that. And I had different times in my sobriety, I've had challenges like that. And, you know, one of the cool things, beautiful things that had happened is that even though that I was told that I would not get my children back, you know, the third, I, you know, going through and third, doing the third step, is that even though the judge said that, is that you guys helped me change that vibration through me. And 8 months to the day of my sobriety, I drove to Montana in a blizzard, and I was right behind the snowplows, you know, on Snoqualmie Pass, going to pick up my daughter because her dad said I could bring her home. And then not too long after that, my son came back too. And, you know, this is the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm ready to give it all up, you know, for some, because I'm feeling a little bit of pity, you know, and not really understanding how, you know, what I could have done as, you know, the miracle that had happened when my children came home. So I'm doing this thing, and my, you know, my children, life is doing good, you know, I'm feeling pretty good about life, and my, I was actually going to school to become a court reporter. And that was even 2 years before I got sober, so you can imagine that. I wondered to myself, I wonder how I'm going to become a court reporter and still live the life I'm living. Can you imagine, like, I'm sitting there in court and I'm gacking out on crack cocaine, you know? It's like, you know, and I was like, and I'd sit there just like, you know, because I've seen what it looks like, because I used to work drug court. It was one of my first jobs when I got sober, and I was working drug court, and I remember watching this woman in the gallery just gacking out, and I remember looking around and see, does anybody else see this, you know? And we had some, I had some pretty cool stories with that. I remember when we had graduation with drug court, the judge was talking a story to one of the men who had graduated, and he was telling the story about how he didn't think he was going to make it. He's like, you know, you really gave us some challenges. They had this thing called the Wizinator. I don't know if you, some of you who are really tricky and sneaky like that, you know, or you had to get, you could actually get the male part and fill it with a particular liquid, and then you can use it, you know, for to pass a urine test, right? And so this guy comes, he's like a white guy, right? And he comes out, he has to take this test, and he pulls out a black Wizinator. Because they wouldn't let him shut the door. Oh my gosh, I was like, oh, the things we think we can get away with, you know? We try, though. We try. And, boy, I was sitting there as a court reporter. My body is just shaking, you know, because I'm laughing so hard, you know. But, yeah, you know, that, you know, Creator put me in some really beautiful places. One of the things I did, too, as a result of walking with you was, you know, I graduated from the Court Reporting Institute, and I got to work for Abigail's Ghost in Seattle and do what's kind of like what you might see as closed captioning as a stenographer, and to help our deaf community within AA to be able to read what was being said. And then right after that, because of anonymity, I would delete the what was said in the meeting, and get to do that again and again, and not, you know, nobody knowing, because, you know, I have to be careful too that I'm as I'm doing my work that I get a meeting too. You know, it's beautiful. So as time had gone on, you know, I was going to school, but I was also
teaching at the night class. And I ended up getting called in to the office. And my and on the other end of the phone was my husband, who told me that, you know, there was a detective at her home, and that they had found my oldest sister on the side of the road, and that she had died from an overdose. And, you know, in our culture, we believe, we understand that death is a part of life, and that, you know, it's not an easy thing to walk through. Like when my grandmother died, she had a good death. You know, she was like in her 80s and she lived a long life. And even though she was blind and had, some things were hard for her, is that she had a good long life. And with my sister being so young, it was like, you know, our whole family suffered that with that. And so we took her to our reservation, and we buried her. And, and the thing for me was this: I was really grateful that I had Alcoholics Anonymous in my life to be able to help me through that experience, you know, to be able to respond to it and take care of my family the way that you've taught me in giving of service. And, it was a hard one because she was so young, and, you know, especially, you know, she was the one who had me like singing the Supremes in the bedroom, you know, and playing Go Fish, and we'd fight, and, you know, she was so much bigger than me, but I would just flop on my back and I would use my feet to kick her, you know, and, you know, that was, you know, she was my big sister. And, but being able to know that, you know, I still had things to do. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember thinking to myself, well, it's been a good 2 years. Maybe I should start really looking at that big book, you know, and because I was still stealing. I remember doing an AA talk for a Magnolia speaker meeting, and I was up there. And I said, yeah, I still steal, but I'm better. And I'm still lying, but I'm getting better, you know, because I just, like, you know, it was just like I couldn't not steal, because that was like part of my life, you know. But I thought to myself, you know, if I'm going to be doing this work, I really think I really need to do the steps, because I would do these steps, you know, like in the beginning is like, you know, do my inventories. And it was like I would say things like, you know, well, I'd be at the bar and I would flirt. You know, I could never tell you the things that would happen as a result of that. You know, sometimes I would come home late. I wasn't writing that sometimes I didn't come home at all, you know. And so I was like, okay, so I can take that deep breath. It says water rises to its own level, right? And I'm hanging out with you. Some of the strength is coming. And I remember just being in this place where it's like, okay, I'm ready to do this. I'm ready to do the things I thought I could never do. Are you okay, Dick? Are you up? Are you okay? okay. And so I ended up, so I remember, like, you know, going through that work, you know, one more time on that fourth step. My sponsor took me out to the big mountain, and I remember walking through the fourth step with her in a way that I had never done before, you know, telling her things that I thought I could never tell anybody. You know, and the beautiful thing that she gave back to me is that she told me she experienced those things too. And gosh, I just love her. Georgia, her name is Georgia, and she was like the first person who introduced me to that fourth column in the book, you know, and the fourth step. And I remember just, you know, the anger that I had at her for even thinking that I had some kind of accountability to, you know, to be a child of abuse or to not trusting people, you know. And, but, you know, boy, she did a beautiful job in helping me. You know, they talk about in that fourth step, you know, that, you know, we see that what it did for me is that, you know, like memories without that emotional charge becomes our wisdom. And that's the gift that she gave me. And I ended up, you know, walking through that, and I remember going through, and I remember still looking at that eighth step and ninth step, and I'm still nervous, you know, but I'm still hanging out with you. And, you know, I'm the sixth step, you know, I kind of thought, you know, entirely ready. I'm entirely ready. Okay, yes, I am. Here you go, God. And that's it. Okay, phew, that's good. Not really realizing I had grosser defects of character. And looking at those things like jealousy was a hard one for me. The first time I met that feeling was I was walking with my stepmom. She let go of my hand and took my sibling's hand, right? And I remember I withdrew physically, mentally, and spiritually. I didn't know what I was experiencing. That's just the pattern I started taking. Boy, my husband sure did have fun with that one, you know? I know you weren't looking, but I know you wanted to,
you know, that kind of thinking. So I remember one time, so he got this letter from an old chum, and he was like, oh my gosh, I've been wondering where she's been. And I was like, who? And he's, you know, says her name. I'm like, oh my God. I could feel myself withdrawing. And I remember this thought that I had is like, I just don't want to make him pay for that. I don't want him to keep on having to, you know, pay for this thing that happens inside of me. So I went and I called my sponsor, and my sponsor, she said, you know, well, I would understand why you'd feel that way. And I'm going, like, you know, that's, you know, there's been something wrong with her lately. So this is probably why she's agreeing with me. And I didn't know at the time, at Georgia, she did. She was, at that point, we didn't know at the time, but she had brain cancer. And so she was acting differently, and that's why when I asked her that, and she, even though she agreed with me, I thought, I'll call somebody else. And then the other woman called, and she's like, well, I would understand why you would feel that way. I'm like, oh, my God. So, you know what? They're agreeing with me because they're women. That's why, you know? And so I remember the thing for me, the ignorance was of that was that I had never dealt with that in a healthy way. And so to have somebody understand that was very foreign to me. But she had me write down the things like, the things like I was feeling vulnerable, I was feeling threatened. And she goes, well, why don't you go ahead and just talk to him about that? I was like, oh, my God, can I just hit him? You know, because I don't want to tell him I'm feeling vulnerable or threatened. You know, it's like, oh, I can't even imagine that. You know, but I followed this direction with her. And, you know, it was a very scary thing to do. And even though, like with my husband, it just looked like, even though he didn't know that I had done this spirit work around it, when I went to talk to him about it in the way that I did, it just looked like to him just the same thing that it always looked like. And he blew up. And I remember, this is the way it's always been, you know. And, you know, and then my sponsor said, and you know what, once you're done talking to him, you leave it alone. So, okay. So I'm downstairs reading my Oprah magazine, probably upside down, you know. And then he came down, and it was the first time I ever created a choice, you know. The first time I ever created a choice in my life. You know, the thing about choice, you know, it's been a gift that was given to us by Creator. And I think about that, you know, the power of choosing wisely. And that if we were, like, when I look at those different things, the bitterness of my past, if I look at those things, like how I would fall to my knees if I was given the opportunity to choose again. And so being able to understand that I was given a choice, but it was through an action that I took, to be able to look at a new idea around this defect of character and a new one, right? And so when I began to walk on this path, you know, I remember it was a Super Bowl. Janet Jackson was going to be there. I love Janet Jackson, but it was really hard to love her when my husband did too. And so I knew she was going to be in the Super Bowl. And my sponsor says, Ronnie, you don't have to go prove how strong you are. You don't have to. I mean, the challenge will come and you'll be able to meet them when they come. You don't have to worry about that. So I said, okay, that's good. Okay, go have a good time, honey. And I was at home and I was cleaning, you know, and I had sponsees that day and life is going good, you know. And I was on the phone with my last sponsee and she said, did you hear that Janet Jackson whipped out her boob at the Super Bowl? And I'm just like, I gotta go. You know? So the next person I call is my sponsor. And she says, you don't get to make him wrong. You know, on, you know, this, oh my gosh. You know, I just really, really want to know, did you see her boob? Did you see it? You know, I'm still at a place where I'm still matching my insides with this 40-year-old boob, you know, but I got work to do, you know. But one of the things, the beautiful things that I know as a result of practicing this work is that I know when I'm taking care of myself spiritually, physically, and mentally, that feeling cannot touch me. Because it has nothing to do, and I always thought it was something on the outside of not being enough. But everything that was happening to me was on the inside. I did not feel enough. And as a result of many inventories and especially 10-step inventories, that's usually one of the biggest things that's been on the top of my list, you know, as far as my beliefs. And so I had to do some work around that. As a child, having both parents, my biological father, I didn't know him until many years later, and my mom leaving because of her alcoholism, it was really hard to believe that I was enough. So, and I just made that up on my own. You know, it's just something that we do as kids, and it had everything to do with me. And I say the self-centered nature of alcoholism, even before I was in the full-blown of my disease, is that it was already very active in my life. So time went on, you know, and, you know, I have my kids under the same roof. I've got a court reporting business. Life is feeling good. And, you know, it was like bought a brand new home. And what a beautiful feeling to wake up and have almost three of my children under the same roof. And I was 2003, October 2003, and I was picturing myself kind of skipping. It was life is good, you know, I have a program, I'm in this thing, you know. I've just done some work, you know, and I got to jump back because I cannot forget about 8 and 9. Because that was really, because when I tell you I was a liar, cheat, and thief, I still got my little thief scar here from the age of 6. And I used to just walk in people's homes, and I would just take orange juice and Jell-O packs, you know, and peanut butter, you know, just kind of things like that, cookies. And I would just do that. I don't know why I never felt like, you know I was being sneaky. It's not something I wouldn't have done, you know, with people knowing that I did that. So I know I was being sneaky, but it was something that I carried on into my adult world. And so I remember that was 8 and 9 was really a difficult place for me to be able to look at, like, making amends for those things. But I was at a conference, and I had my list out and everything, and I was like thinking, oh, my gosh, I got to go to Canada. I got to go to Montana. This is going to be a hard one. But I was at a conference in Seaside, Oregon, and there was a gentleman, standing at the pulpit, and he was talking about how he used to rob homes. And I was sitting right, you know, this is a time when they had like 2,000, they didn't have a cap on it yet, you know, and there's like 2,000 people in the room, and he's up there telling the story. And I'm sitting there somewhere in the audience and, you know, listening to him, how he would, you know, he has his list, and he's going knocking on door to door. Did you live here at such and such a time? Right? And if they said yes, he would let them know that he was the one who made him, that he was the one who robbed their homes, and that he was prepared to make amends, but also restitution. And I'm sitting there, and I am just glued onto this man, right? I'm just sitting here, you got to be kidding me. You know, I'm thinking that those are the ones you just kind of let slide, Rhonda, just don't do it again while you're sober, you know? And but I remember, like, I'm sitting there, and he's talking about going house to house to house. And and he said he gets to the last house, and he's not in jail yet, but he gets to the last house, and he knocks on the door, and nobody answers. You know that? Have you had that thing where you had the courage to do it, and then you had to find the courage again because they didn't answer the phone or something? You know, it's kind of like that, you know. And he said about third or fourth time, he said he went there, and he said he knocked on the door, and an old man answered the door. And he said, did you live here at such and such a time? And the old man said, yes. And he said, well, I was the one who robbed your home, and I've come here to make amends and to pay restitution. And I'm paraphrasing the story, just to let you know, okay? So the old man said, come in, come in. And so he invited him in, and I'm still like in awe because what was this? I mean, you can't make this stuff up, right? I'm just like, oh my gosh. I mean, so I'm sitting there, and he introduces him to the wife. And he says, you know, and he was able to make amends to the wife. And the wife says, you know, thank you so much because all this time we thought it was our son. And that's something, that's what the whole room did, you know, because, and that, recognizing the power of what we do to people, you know. I think about the word God, and I had a hard time with God too, you know, but I remember someone saying, you know, Rhonda, the word water isn't going to make you wet. The word fire is not going to burn you. So don't get caught up in a word that we use to be able to communicate, but find out what the God of your understanding is. And to be able to come to a place, I was, you know, and I heard that, I remember thinking, who am I not to take care of that? And I wasn't just skipping like, okay, I'm gonna go to Canada and Montana to do that. I remember I was afraid. And I sat with my sponsor, and she said, you know, Ron, I need you to understand something, is that, you know, we don't just check these things off like a checklist, you know. I want you to understand what you did to yourself and what you did to those people. Is when you walked into that home and you stole those clothes, did you know that you left behind your peace of mind and you took away their sacredness? Did you know when you stole that bracelet that you gave away your freedom, you left your freedom and you took away their sacredness? You know when you said those unkind words, you gave your freedom. And what you're going to do is you're going to go back and you give those people back their sacredness. And in return, you will receive these things. And that was something I had always heard, you know, you don't deserve anything. You just be thankful you're sober. And I understand that too. Maybe I don't, but I can't live in a life of God that looks at me like that. You know, I've lived in a place where I didn't think I was enough, you know, that God didn't like me, told me I was abomination to God, many things like that. And so I needed to have a God that I could trust, that loved me. And so when I went and I took care of those things, the same thing happened for me, was that I was able to find people I didn't think I was going to be able to find. And yeah, so I'm sitting, I'm rocketing into the fourth dimension. I wanted to know what happy, joyous, and free is, and I was given that. And as I was going through, I said, I have my court reporting business, my children are home, have a brand new house, everything's feeling pretty darn good, and the phone rings, October 2003. And there was on the other end of the line, there was a man from King 5 News, and he said, I just want to ask what your thoughts are about your sister being murdered by Gary Ridgway. And I was like, I'm sorry, you got the wrong number. My sister died 5 years ago. And he's like, no. He said, we have a pretty reliable source at the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office that your sister was murdered by the Green River Killer. Now, when you had this morning, when I was listening to, you know, Melina share, you know, that's a very, it was kind of interesting that this was going to be the bookend. You know, because what a powerful story to be able to walk through. And, you know, I think that the interesting thing about it, and I would say, I don't know if it's interesting or what, but is that, you know, we got to find out, you know, and I think it would be harder to have not known. I'm not the type of person, I would rather know the truth. And so when I still thought that the guy was pulling my leg, you know, I had Green River Killer. I was like, you know, I kind of marked that up with like Freddy Krueger, you know, like, you know, Michael Myers, you know, that kind of stuff. That stuff doesn't happen to us. It happens on scary movies and, you know. And so I remember hanging up because I still wasn't convinced, and I hung up and the phone rang right away. And it was my sister, and I could hear her sniffling. My sister at the time was working for Norm Mailing. She was a paralegal of his, and interesting thing that she wanted to work on the Ridgway as a paralegal for Ridgway, and she didn't get the job, but because they were already in this planning place where something was happening, and I could hear her sniffling. I said, "Did you get that phone call too?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "How could they possibly know? I mean, it was 5 years ago, For those of you who don't know, is that he was on death row for some of the women he had killed, and he made a plea bargain with the state to be able to admit to, at that time, 48, maybe it's 49 by now, women's lives he had taken, and my sister was the last among them. So to be the first on the list, and then the last, I just find that very fascinating. You know, I don't even know how somebody could even keep track of that stuff, but I remember, you know, it broke my heart to what was happening to my mom, because my mom was still here at the time. And so we, you know, the same thing, we were in the courtroom, you know, and I remember thinking, yeah, I know you guys told me that God doesn't make junk, but it was a very, very difficult thing for me to be able to understand. When my dad had written a letter because he wasn't able to make it. My sister was going to go up and talk, and then my brother was going to join her. I have a couple of, you know, few brothers, so it was, one of my brothers was going to go and join her. And he didn't show up the next day. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, like, what am I going to do? How am I going to just let her go up there by herself? You know, I was like, I didn't know how to handle that. But, you know, as things began to unfold, it was an experience where there was an old man who went up, and Maybe he might have been old, but he looked like Santa Claus. You know, he was beautiful. He looked like Santa Claus. He was, and actually that's what he said he did, is that he would play Santa Claus during the holiday season. And he walked up, and my sister was, still a few people behind. And he said, Gary, you challenged me on something that I believe every man and woman deserves. He said, you've challenged me to my core. And that is that every man and woman deserves forgiveness. And I forgive you. And all of a sudden, Gary broke and he began to cry. Now, people before this that were up there, they were cursing him and cussing him and saying things like, I hope you rot, you SOB, and cussing him. And his face was stoic, just kind of listening, But when this man gave him forgiveness, what I saw is what you had taught me, is that I watched forgiveness penetrate the evil. And I also don't know what it would be like to have Santa Claus up there giving you forgiveness, right? And so what it did for me is it gave me the courage to be able to go up and talk, be with my sister, and then to be able to tell this man who he had killed. Patricia was an alcoholic. Her alcoholism led her into the hands of this experience. Not that that's a right or an excuse or anything like that. I used to always wonder, how did I make it? And she didn't. I don't want to have a God that's going to pick me and not my sister. And, I was really fortunate. I kept asking that question over and over. And some people would say, you don't ask, just be grateful, And my response today says, that's when people don't really know the answer. So he said, keep on asking your questions, ask your questions, and I kept on doing that. And I remember my friend Linda had come back from a conference like this, and she said that Clancy I was there, and that Clancy said if it was by the grace of God alone that we would not be stepping over people in Skid Row. If it was by the grace of God alone, people would not be dying from cirrhosis of the liver. It was by grace of God alone that people wouldn't be dying from alcoholic car crashes, but that it takes a willingness. And then I knew. I understood. Because my sister sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and she rolled the dice one more time, and she didn't get to come back. See, we're always going to be here. We're always going to be here. But it doesn't mean that you're going to get to come back if you decide to come back, decide to go back out. As time had gone on, I get to play the Native American flute. I would not have been able to do that without you. It was like there was a certain spirit to have in this instrument. There's a certain sobriety that's really important to it in the world and what I have to offer the world. And, I have, I just want to say that because I will play something for you at the very end. But on April, a couple years ago, on March 26th, I have a son, and his name was Daniel. And he was beautiful, but he had alcoholism. And my son had three beautiful children, but in the state of his alcoholism, he took his life. And I'm going to tell you something, to me, I'm just like, how much can a person take? What is this, But the thing of it is I remember the day after I was coming home, Daniel was in Montana, and I was coming home, and I remember I was come back from the airport driving with my sisters, and I looked at my sisters, and I said, oh, my God, I feel peace. I feel peace. How does this happen? And when I talked to my sponsor about it, my sponsor said, Rana, you do fourth dimension work every day, and I do, upon awakening with my review at night. You do fourth dimension work every day. It's inevitable that peace will come for you. And I want to tell you that that's exactly what happened, is that I didn't beg to God, please give me peace. It just came up and through me because the channel was open and for that peace to come. And that I'm sitting there and I'm in this place where I'm kind of just tossed into this experience, it feels like. And I'm watching people come around me, and I see a woman who lost her daughter, who had experienced the death of her daughter, years ago, and still can't come out of the grief. And then I was invited to go speak at the Desert Roundup, and I'm talking to a woman who doesn't even know that I just experienced the death of my son. And she begins to bear witness to the death of her three sons. And I'm sitting there watching this as these things begin unfolding in front of me, not just this. You know, I met many people who have had children, you know, family members who have died at the hands of another, you know. But the difference is, it's like, if we understood the power of choice, then we choose wisely. And I remember looking when, you know, at these two examples. And I remember thinking, not that I judge this. It's not for me. That's for her. But this is what I choose. And I fall, and I just started watching, you know, following the guidance of my sponsor. I will tell you that, you know, the day after Daniel died, I have a check-in with my sponsor at 9 o'clock. 9:05, I didn't call. He understood what I was going through. He calls me up and he says, Ronnie, do not let your death of your son overshadow your AA program. The life that you have is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And different times he's told me before too, because when I'm out getting awards and you know, standing ovations for my flutes and the things that were happening, don't let your bright life overshadow your AA program. And I love a sponsor that cares more about my life than my feelings. I really do. Because when he starts breaking out in feelings and he can't sing the song Feelings, you know, yeah, so I get it. You know, but it really helped me through that to understand the difference between self-pity and grief. I can tell the difference between self-pity and grief by the thoughts I'm thinking in my head. If I'm in the woulda, coulda, shouldas, what ifs, you can rest assured that self-pity is going to follow that. Grief has there's a place that Creator has given us with grief that gives us the ability to be able to, integrate an experience like what happened to me. Because I don't really believe that I don't think there's a healing here. I really don't. I think it's more what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is more about integration. To heal is to fix. It's not going to be fixed. But to integrate is that you're helping me become a woman that can bear witness to those who may walk through this experience and be able to say, I know what that's about, and I know how to guide you through that. And I will tell you that, you know, I have 6 grandchildren today. And you know, when Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to embrace my spirit of AA, my spirit of my culture. And I looked at Reagnostics. You know, I came in my 23rd year, not 23rd, in my 23rd year, I began the guidance of a new sponsorship. And I could see the holes. My relationship was beginning to manifest within my relationships. And my sponsors helped me to understand. I remember thinking, how do they send me to these really beautiful places? And I'm still waking up thinking, what fresh hell is this? You know, what's going on with me that I still feel this chronic doubt? You know, what is happening to me? And so when my sponsor reintroduced me to the chapter 4, We Agnostics, I will tell you, I have a very beautiful spirituality. I do. We have the sweat lodge. We got, you know, we have pipe ceremony, and not the kind of pipes you're thinking. We have, you know, dance ceremonies. We have, you know, just beautiful, beautiful ways. So I want to tell you that I'm not agnostic, but I do have an agnostic temperament. You know, there's times when I forget, you know, that how to tap into that power. And when I wake up in the morning and I'm in that fear for no reason at all, or I'm angry for no reason at all, is that not only did I understand that is agnosticism for the alcoholic, but also what was the solution. And the solution for me was steps 10, 11, and 12. And every once in a while, you know, I might go, oh, you know, I'm going to do my 11th step, you know. And today's a bright, sunny day. I think I'm going to do my 11th step, you know. And then I might forget it, you know, and kind of hit it here and there of realizing that that was everything that I am as the alcoholic I am was completely, I was beginning to, I guess, have a bottom in my AA life, you know. I've learned that you'll have bottoms in, you know, drinking, but you'll also have bottoms here, you know. And for me, it was just more of an indicator that I needed to move from where I was to something, to a higher learning, and that's what my sponsor has given me. I know that they talk about, you know, men should stay with men and women should stay with women. And for many years I did, and probably more for the sake of the men that I did that. Because I didn't know that I also objectified men. I was objectified, but I was also objectifying men. But I also, you know, when it talks about in that first tradition, you know, our common welfare should come first, personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And so when I would hear things that, you know, a woman, you know, under our, how does it go? Like a man, a woman will save your butt, but a man will slap it or pat it or something. All right, I'm not going to curse because my sponsor doesn't like me. Keep it clear. But also too, then I would hear men say something like, well, you know, over every slip is a woman in a dress, something like that. And I just thought, you know, what it came down to is that, you know, there's a place of learning discernment. I couldn't have done that in my early sobriety. I could not have been working with another man. And so God, AA guided me and put me in the hands of the places that I needed to be. But it came to a place in my life where working with my sponsor, Wayne, was very important to me, because as a result of working with him, and he doesn't care about my feelings, he doesn't at all. But that the fact of the matter is that the guidance he gave me in understanding agnosticism, and also to understand the work that I need to do, and that's keeping, you know, making sure that I do on a daily basis. Like looking up words like completely, right? And you think you know what the word means. Thoroughly, you think you know, but you have to really know the word daily. I had even look at that word simply because I was not doing it on a daily basis. And what happened for me as a result of going under the aegis of that sponsorship, when that tragedy hit, there's a saying, nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune, but keep away from dark imaginings. Fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. That, you know, it's like I needed to have a place where this experience was going to happen. I wasn't preparing for it, but I will tell you that I was prepared for it. And that gave me ability when the pipe carriers came in and they told me that I had the ability and responsibility to teach my family how to grieve. How about that? To teach my children, my daughters, my grandchildren how to grieve. Because if I'm fortunate enough that I get to leave before them, then I would love for them to be able to walk through that with the grace and the dignity and the integrity that Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me to walk through the deaths and the experiences of my life. My dad left and passed over in April. And I say, sometimes I go, Dad, I'm so, you know, I love you. You know I do, but I just have not had the same kind of grief for my dad as I had for my son. So it still is overriding. And I miss my dad, don't get me wrong. He was beautiful. And I just want to go ahead and say that, you know, the beautiful thing that I've learned about steps 4 through 9 is it takes a humility to walk through those things. And this, the disciplines of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the life that I have. I stay true to the work and the disciplines I've been guided to do. I have understood for the first time that this is not a theory. When my son died, I understood this is not a theory. This is a way of life. And that when it talks about, you know, humility, not proud or haughty, not arrogant or assertive, but a clear recognition of what and who I really am, followed by a sincere attempt to become what I could be, is that steps 4 through 9 are that sincere attempt method. And this, I learned that from my sponsor. And then, I mean, sure, my sponsor probably learned it from somebody else too, but also to help the sincere attempt method to be free from the bondage of self. And that 10, 11, and 12, they're the place where I maintain that freedom from the bondages of self and to be a woman about that, you know. And so, and now I get to share something else that's really beautiful and why we keep on keeping on. My grandson got married last year, and I thought, holy smokes, I'm going to be a great grandmother someday, you know. And then so it was like, was it December, yeah, he called and said that they're going to have a baby. So I'm going to be a great grandma. And I didn't even, yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I didn't even think I was going to make it to 16, you know. So I'm really grateful for that. And, you know, one of the things I do when I do my morning, I always do the Desiderata, which I was guided with, you know, by my sponsor, is what our father, Ed Dowling, taught Bill W. For the daily reflection. And but one of the things it says, therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive God to be. And whatever your labors and aspirations and the noisy confusion of life, keep peace in your soul. Through all its sham and drudgery and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be cheerful, strive to be happy. And thank you so much that you've helped me to take the hard things in my life and to make them my wisdoms, because maybe one day you might need them. And I hope, I pray that this will be something you can look back on. So thank you very much. Thank you.